Okay, so I should start now.
Sure.
Okay. Hi, everybody. Welcome. This is the last lecture of the course. I wanted to warn you, I may be a bit out of sorts today. I've had a big problem today. This morning when I was on my email, someone sent me an email saying, someone I know saying, click on this, it'll show some funny people. So I clicked on it, and it got some false security system, something like Windows XP security, and it turned out it was fraudulent, and so I've had my debit card changed, and I had to have someone fix my computer. He spent a couple hours fixing it, so I'm a bit distracted today. I hope it doesn't make my lectures even more disjointed than usual. Now, you remember, in this lecture, I want to deal with three topics, intellectual property, foreign policy, morality, war, that are very much of interest to people and where the objectivists have a very distinctive point of view. But before I do that, I wanted to go over a very interesting question that somebody asked me. I thought last, it was an important point, I thought I didn't have at all a good answer to what the questioner was suggesting, but it's a very interesting point. You remember, we've been discussing in this course kind of the principal theme in Rand's ethics, it's the morality of rational egoism. Each person will take his or her own life as the standard of ethics, and then that's how you determine what's right or wrong, what will best secure your own survival. However, this doesn't mean, remembering Rand's system, that you're supposed to exploit others or be parasites on them. On the contrary, you're supposed to respect other people's rights. So if everybody is self-interested, but you respect the fact that other people are self-interested and you respect their rights. Now, there are exceptions to this. For example, suppose there's an emergency situation where there's only, say, enough for two people on an island, there's only enough food for one, then it's either you or the other person. In that case, it's an emergency situation, you can act to your own advantage. You can take the food for yourself, because remember, this is the morality of egoism. But aside for emergency situation, then the objectivist view is that everybody's interested in harmony, so we don't have situations where it's to your advantage to violate other people's rights. Now, remember, last time we raised the objection to this, well, aren't there cases where it seems you could benefit by violating other people's rights? One example is things one that John Hospers have. Imagine somebody works in a bank and he embezzles money from the bank, just steals one time, and then he acts in a perfectly ordinary way after he's never found out. So what Rand said about the case, well, she thinks the person would always be afraid that he'd be found out, he'd always live in fear. But that didn't seem too plausible, at least not too plausible to me. So the problem that I raised for Rand, or that other people have raised for Rand besides me, is that it doesn't seem to be always the case that if you act in your own interest, it's always in your interest to respect the rights of others. Maybe in most cases it would be, but there seem to be some where it isn't. Like you could, in this case, you can just get away with stealing from someone and you have a whole lot of money. Why should you respect their rights in this case? Now, someone mentioned, it was a very good point, this is a point I didn't have a good answer to. Well, the objectivist response there is the embezzler is living a lie or faking reality. So we want to see, is this a good response? If we say, well, this embezzler is faking reality, is he faking reality? And if so, is that a good reason to say it's really not in his interest to violate other people's rights because he doesn't want to fake reality? Now, we have to ask, what do we mean by faking reality? Well, one thing, it's clearly in your own interest, at least in most cases, to have a correct perception of reality. For example, to take our bank embezzler, he should certainly be aware that he's embezzled money. It wouldn't be a good idea if he just had no idea he'd taken the money. We generally want it to be the case that we perceive reality accurately. If we want to survive, it's a very good idea that I know exactly what's going on. For example, if I'm crossing the street, it's clearly in my interest to know if there's a car coming that would hit me. I have to have an accurate perception of what's going on. Certainly we want accurate perception of reality, so we wouldn't want to fake reality in the sense that we would have incorrect beliefs about the world. Now, it's interesting, though, possibly there are some exceptions to that. Bob Nozick, in his book, Nature Rationality, that's, I should say, one of my favorite of his books because he mentioned me in the acknowledgement pages, so I like that book. So that was a joke, you're supposed to laugh. So Nozick gives some cases where it might not be true that you would do best if you have a correct perception of reality, correct beliefs about reality. For example, supposing someone overrates his own ability. They imagine some scientist who thinks, well, I'm the next Isaac Newton. And his having that kind of inflated view of himself enables him to make certain discoveries, of course, not as great as Newton's, but he's able to do more than he would if he had an accurate perception. Maybe if he thinks, well, he's all right as a scientist, but not all that great, he wouldn't discover as much as he could if he had this inflated opinion of himself. There's a psychologist named Seligman, who is a student of Nozick, who's done some work on this called learned optimism. So when the idea is you have a higher view of your own abilities than is justified, and your having this higher ability enables you to do better than you otherwise would. This is an example maybe where you would be in your interest to have an incorrect belief. Or another example is, let's suppose someone's on trial for some really horrible crime, and the person's mother believes that the person is innocent, even though there's a whole lot of evidence against the person. She just can't take the idea that her son is guilty of some horrible crime. So maybe if she had the accurate perception, maybe she thought her son was guilty of this horrible crime, then she'd just have a complete nervous breakdown. She'd collapse. She couldn't take it. So it's to her advantage there, help her survive. If she had the incorrect belief her son was innocent, even though the evidence is the other way. So as I say, Nozick gives some cases where it might be in your own interest to fake reality. But let's assume that the bank embezzler isn't one of these exceptions. Let's assume it's in the bank embezzler's interest to have an accurate perception of reality. He's not one of these exceptions. Okay, so suppose we assume that. So then we get, it's in the interest of the embezzler to be aware that he's stolen money. Wait, there's someone who's asked me a question here. Let me just look at this one sec here. Ted says, how can he discover that he's better than he they were just having the lower. Well, Ted, it isn't that the person discovers he's better than he is. He just has a sort of a view of himself. He thinks, I'm really good. And in fact, he isn't. I mean, if he had an exact perception of how good he was, then the hypothesis of Seligman is that he wouldn't have been able to discover as much as he did. It's sort of having the inflated view of yourself enables you to do better than you would if you had an accurate perception. It isn't just that he has, this hypothesis isn't just that he does better with an accurate perception if he just thought he was no good and he really was good. It's his thinking he's better than he was enables him to do pretty good. It's not that his thinking he's better himself than he is makes him as good as he thinks he is. It's just that thinking he's better than he really is makes him better than he would be otherwise. Now, let's see, Lucas is objecting. Lucas thinks it's a bit of a stretch. Well, I mean, it may be a bit of an argument. I mean, there's empirical research to support such things, at least if we believe Seligman. Maybe Seligman has an overly inflated view of himself and thinks he's done convincing research when he hasn't. But, I mean, this is at least one way I cause this to consider. But as I say, it's not going to be essential to the argument I'm going to be giving. So even if you don't like this, now let me just see. I think good, we're starting some good arguments here. Accurate would give the same, but I mean, that's just rejecting the hypothesis. The hypothesis that's not the case. If an inflated view, you do better. Maybe you just find it counterintuitive that somebody would do better with an inflated view of yourself. But that's at least the hypothesis of this particular psychologist Seligman has done his research on. He thinks sometimes you're thinking, well, if somebody had a really inflated view of himself, then he'd get into a lot of trouble. But he's not supposing that you're really that radically out of line. Maybe I shouldn't have given you examples of you. It's just you have a somewhat higher opinion of yourself than you really. It's really justifiable that enables you to do better. So, but anyway, we're not going to be assuming that's the case for this argument. So it's, as I say, it's in the interest of the embezzler to be aware that he's stolen money. It's also in the interest of others that they be aware of his crime. Certainly the owners of the bank would like to know that the bank clerk has stolen the money, then they fire him or send him to have him arrested. So really in their interest that he be aware that he stole the money. But the question is, and then here's the heart of the objection to this point about faking reality, why is it in the interest of the embezzler to assist others to a better perception of reality when this would have bad consequences for him? Supposing he, other people knew he'd stolen the money, then he'd be going to jail. So it's not in his interest that they have a correct perception of reality. So this is just the question of the harmony of interest, which is what's up for discussion. The objectivist response that everybody has its harmony of interest is really begging the question here, because this appears to be a case where it's not in your interest that everyone have a correct perception of reality. So the answer to this faking reality objection is, well, you're not faking your own perception of reality, and it's not in your interest that other people have a correct perception of reality. Now, you might object to that. You might think, oh, but if everybody went around facing reality in these cases wouldn't be all much worse off, because then we wouldn't have accurate information about what was going on. But you see, that again is just a prisoner's dilemma case. Even if it were true, we'd all be better off if everybody was open and honest and didn't fake things. That doesn't say why it's not in my interest right now to fake things, if it's to my advantage, because I can't bring about what everybody else is going to be. So it's really, this facing reality objection is really just repeating the same points we made about observing other people's rights in the first place. It, sometimes it appears it's not in your interest. Okay, so now, having gone over that, I want to go into the first of the topics when covering lecture today, intellectual property. I picked this because, if you follow the Mises website, this is getting a lot of attention. I think Stefan Kinsella on the Mises Academy is very interested. He's one of the authorities on this issue, and he's taught a course on it, I think. I know Jeff Tucker's very interested in it. And Rand had very strong views on this question, which were very different from those of Kinsella and Tucker, and also from those of Murray Rothbard, who I think is the best source on patent copyright. So Rothbard's position, as you know, was that patent copyrights are really not legitimate, but what we can have is we can have contractual arrangements where people agree, say, not to make copies of things, but these are just between the parties who were involved in the contracts. But Rand didn't agree with this. She thought there should be patents and copyrights. And how did she support that view? Well, remember, in the objectivist argument, property rights arise from your freedom of action. Each person creates value, that say things you act to gain or keep. So that whenever I say I see some resources out there, see some land, so I, let's say I do something with the land, I build a farm on it. So the land is a value for me because it's something I act to gain or keep, and she thinks I can do that, I can acquire the property because that's part of my freedom of action. I'm free to do whatever I want that doesn't violate other people's rights, so I'm free to acquire property if no one else has a claim to it. So how she applies this to ideas, she thinks that because an inventor has come up with a new idea, he's created. Supposing, say, when Edison came up with the idea of the electric light bulb, other people hadn't thought of that, so he's really created the idea. So she thinks this gives him a property right in it. I should say, it's a good thing that Edison did invent the electric light bulb, because otherwise we'd all be watching television by candlelight. You're supposed to laugh there. I'm sorry. You have to laugh. I can't wait. Justin says he's choking on your own tongue. Well, don't do that. Then we'll have to give you the Heimlich minute. Now, Jonathan wants to know, what if someone comes up with the same idea independently? We'll be getting to that. That's a very good point, and that's one of the big objections. Now, you might immediately object to what Rand has said, and this is one objection you get, I'm sure, from Stella, is that only physical objects can be owned, not an idea. You can only own a physical object, so I can own, say, on a land that nobody else has owned, but I can't own an idea. Supposing I'm the idea, Edison has the idea of an electric light bulb. Well, I mean, he may have that idea, but as Jonathan just said, other people can come up with the idea. So how can he own an idea in somebody else's mind just because he was the first one to come up with it? So well, I see this is going to get into a lot of good arguments here on this one, so I'll just go on. We can have the arguments in the discussion after the lecture. I see I hit a hot one on this one. Good. I can patent this. Okay, so the objection is, well, how can you own an idea in somebody else's mind? So Rand didn't deny that only physical objects can be owned. She thought that a patent has to apply to a physical device. For example, Edison, in her view, wouldn't be patenting the idea of a light bulb. He'd be patenting a particular object. Say, you built a light, you have a light bulb that would be built, and then other people couldn't make copies of this without his permission. And similarly, the copyright applies to physical objects, a book or article. So if you hold a patent, in her view, you couldn't forbid others from talking about what you've invented. The prohibition applies only to making copies of the physical device. So Edison couldn't say, well, other people can't talk about light bulbs. It's just that in her view, remember, I should say, I'm not endorsing her view, quite the contrary. I'm just trying to present what her view is. You will be dealing with some criticism. But her view is that the prohibition applies only to making copies of the physical device. Now, here it's very important that she's using value, and she says the value is something you act to gain or keep, in a different way from the way it's customary in Austrian economics. Remember, in Austrian economics, what we do, we have, say, you can have choices, say, among different things you're going to do, and you rate the choices according to your preferences. So you have your preference for doing one thing, your first preference, your second preference. So value, say, if I say, suppose I said something like, what is the value to me of this glass of water? Incidentally, I may not look like a cup of water, but I certainly feel like one. So value here would be my subjective estimate of, say, based on what I want to do with the glass of water, the cup of water, is to drink it. So the value is where that would rank on my scale of preferences. So Rand is using value in a different sense. She's using it as an object. It's something that you gain or keep. So the value for her would not be where the use of the cup of water, namely drinking it, ranks on the scale of preferences. It would be the value would be the actual glass or cup. So the value is what you have to gain or keep. It isn't a subjective judgment on where something ranks in your preference scale. So it isn't really a good objection to Rand to say, oh, well, she has the false view that you can own values, you can only own physical objects, because she's using value, values are physical objects. So she's really not vulnerable to that objection, at least I'm not seeing why she is. Now, Rand made a sharp distinction when she was talking about patents between inventions and discoveries. You can't patent a law of nature or something that's out there to be found out. For example, when Einstein was working on his special relativity theory, say one of his ideas is there's no preferred frame of reference that you can use to find what absolute motion is. So suppose he was the first one to think of that. He couldn't patent that because it should take that a discovery. That's something that's out there in nature. If he's got it right, then he's discovered the law of nature. So he can't patent that. And we can see why Rand might hold that, why you can't say you can patent the discovery. Because for Rand, new concepts are abstractions from perception. Remember, we discussed in the earlier lectures Rand's theory of concepts, where we perceive the world through the senses, and then through process of measurement or mission, we come up with concepts, and then we can get theories by having further abstractions from these concepts. But it's all based in reality. So you don't create the physical law, you discover it. We can see, as we see many times in discussing Rand's philosophy, her theory of concept is extremely important. Now, on the other hand, an inventor does bring into existence a physical object that wouldn't have existed without his action. When Edison developed the light bulb, well, there wouldn't have been light bulbs if he hadn't brought certain materials together. The materials are out there in the world, but he had to bring them together in to get a light bulb out of them. And there's Johnny there, you can't patent genetic sequences. That's an interesting question. I mean, it would maybe you could patent a model of it, of the genetic sequence. I think if nobody come up with that before, you couldn't patent what's in somebody's body and prevent him from using his own genetic structure. Now, I want to raise, the distinction she makes between invention and discovery, I'm not sure it's a good one, or I might want to go a bit stronger on that, but I'm pretty sure it isn't a good distinction. What you have a right to if you own a patent is not just a physical object, but the power to prevent others from building an object that embodies your idea. So, when say, pick on Edison again, it's not just that he's constructed a light bulb, and he owns this model of the light bulb he's constructed. He can prevent other people from using his idea to build light bulbs without getting his permission, presumably paying him to do it. So the problem I have this here is, on the one hand, Rand is saying, well, you can't own a discovery because when you discover the law of nature, this is just based on abstraction from perception. So you don't own what's out there in reality. You're just finding out what's there in nature. But couldn't you say the same thing about Edison? Isn't his idea, at least if Rand's been constantly correct, she's not going to question that, isn't her idea based on abstraction from perception? So, and then we can look at it from the other side. If you can prevent others from copying your idea, if you have an invention or you built some physical device, why can't discoverers of new ideas prevent others from using their discoveries, not in the sense of stopping others from thinking about their discovery, but supposing, say, they build some actual physical device that makes use of the new discovery. Say, imagine people building an atomic bomb and depend on certain discoveries in theoretical physics. Why can't the physicists who come up with those discoveries say, well, we can't stop you from talking about the ideas, but you don't have the right to build something that's based on our ideas. So I don't think Rand has come up with a good way of distinguishing discoveries from inventions. She can't really separate them in a way that would permit her to say, well, people shouldn't be allowed to patent discoveries for those laws of nature, but they can patent inventions. Now, aside from that, there, I think, a big problem in the way Rand argues for a right to intellectual property. It isn't clear, at least not clear to me, how the argument is supposed to proceed. Supposing that an inventor does create his new idea in the way she suggests, let's think of Edison again, he's come up with this idea for an electric light bulb. Nobody had the idea before. So why does it follow that other people should be prohibited from using the idea without his permission? Well, she says, well, he's created the idea, but again, why does that mean that other people can't use it? Just why? She said, well, he's created, therefore he has a right to it, and since he can stop other people from using it, so, but why is that? I see some other thing. I see a lot of people making comments, so let me just have a look here. Yes, David Kelly says Rothbard has this one correct. Yes, I think that's right. I think Rothbard was right. Good, and there's a joke about Hank Reardon. Good. Again, it might be in the inventor's interest that others not be allowed to use his idea without his permission. Maybe Edison would do very well if other people had to pay him whenever they wanted to use the light bulb. But why do other people have a moral obligation to do what's in the inventor's interest? And you'll see, this is the general problem of the objectivist theory of rights. I say, well, it's in your interest, say, you do something, say you acquire property because you're exercising your freedom of action. Say, I see some land there, so I farm it. So then, this is part of my freedom of action. But why then do I have the right to stop other people from using what I claim to appropriate? If it's in my interest, why does this impose a moral duty on others to respect what I've done? So again, the problem with Rand's argument for patents and copyright is a general problem for her whole theory of right, that she, to show that something is in your interest isn't sufficient to show that other people have a moral obligation to respect your interest. Now, I might mention here a point, it's really peripheral to this main argument, which is one of its most philosophical interests, how you get from interest to right. So the question, is patent protection in the inventor's interest? That we've said, well, wouldn't it be to Edison's advantage if other people had to pay him to use a light bulb? Now, Rothbard in Mankind and State, a book by Michelle Boldrin and David Levine called Against Intellectual Monopoly, they challenge this. No doubt certain inventors do benefit from patents, but they think overall these benefits have been exaggerated, and if you're just doing it on a strictly consequentialist basis, what would have the best consequences for promoting inventions, they don't think patents would lead to have the best results. But I mean, that's would require a whole course in itself. I just mentioned that. So you shouldn't assume, just take for granted that even if the inventor can't establish he has a right to the patent, then at least we know it's in his interest. Maybe it isn't. So we should Rothbard and Bolger and Levine are to be credited. I think they raise strong points. Now, I want to raise, before we turn from patents to foreign policy, which is climate transition, there's some other problems with Rand's view of intellectual property. One is that she thinks that patent protection should extend only for a certain number of years, not forever. And this limit takes account of the fact that often many people are working on an invention, new invention at the same time. There was someone who asked about this point, what other people have been working on inventions. So if you say, well, the first one who thinks of it should get the patent, what about these other people? Why should they be shut out even if they were thinking of the idea? So in those kind of situations come up pretty often. There was an old sociologist named S. Collinger Fillon, I used to know back in the when I was just finished my PhD at UCLA. I'll put him down. His book called The Sociology of Invention, he has a number of cases where people are working on the same invention at the same time. He was a very interesting person. When I met him, he said he was 88. He said, anyway, you look at it forwards, backwards, upside down, it's 88. I remember he once showed me his Phi Beta Kappa key, said University of Pennsylvania, 1910. But that's it. Aside, that's a bit off topic, but that doesn't stop me. Once the limit, the length of time you get patents is that people need to do productive work, and if you had a perpetual patent, she thinks this would encourage people to be parasites. If you had this perpetual patent, maybe you wouldn't want to come up with new ideas. So just live off the patent. But even if this is true, namely that other people want to be fair to other people who are working on the invention at the same time and want to avoid danger of parasitism, why should it limit the inventor's rights if you had a genuine right? And suppose you have a right to a certain object, to your property. Well, even if it wouldn't be all that good for you to have the right, it's still yours, maybe. Say I'm an alcoholic and I own some whiskey, maybe it would be better for me if I didn't use the whiskey, but it's still mine. So Rand seems to be asking what would be good for the inventor, what would be good for society, rather than what he has a right to in a way that doesn't apply to other rights. So she really doesn't seem to be on too sound ground there. I see Peggy recommends the Bolger and Levine. Yes, I think it's a very good book. I reviewed it in my Mises review, I think very favorably, which is rare for me for a book. I usually manage to say something bad about a book, but that one is quite good. Now we can shift now to foreign policy. Not quite a shift, but this is also very issue of interest to a lot of people. Rand didn't write a great deal on foreign policy. Before Pearl Harbor, she was a non-interventionist like most of those on the old right. Remember the old right, or kind of the classical liberals, people like Albert J. Nock, H. John Mencken, the ones that Rothbard looked to as his intellectual ancestors. So after the World War II began, September 1939, the non-interventionists thought, well, the U.S. should really stay out of things. Of course, they didn't like Hitler, but they thought getting into the world won't really do any good. It'll have bad consequences. So before Pearl Harbor, Rand was a non-interventionist. But after the war, she supported the Cold War against the Soviets, and she tended to take a very pro-Israel position on the Middle East. But foreign policy wasn't her specialty. She was a nationally well-informed person. She was had views on it, but she didn't really say all that much about it. But some of her followers, which is Leonard Peikoff, who's the head of the Ayn Rand Institute, and Yaron Brook, who's one of the leading people in that institute. Brook is actually the head of it. Peikoff's the one who's the Rand's heir to more copyright. So they have more to say on it. And what I want to do in time remaining is to go over some of the things they've said. And here, one of the most important statements of objectivist foreign policy is in a book by C. Bradley Thompson, which has a chapter with Yaron Brook called Neoconservatism, an Obituary for an Idea. I think this is a very good book on the whole. It's a discussion of the neocon, had a great deal on the political philosopher Leo Strauss. Thompson thinks Leo Strauss is really the philosophical father of neoconservatism, whose influence on Irving Kristol is one of the main neoconservatives. Now, Lucas has raised it about how can a nation live? Well, this is a point we'll be getting into, which was an objection to what she said. But the thesis that she defended in this book by Thompson Brook is that just as an individual should live by the morality of rational egoism, a nation should do so as well. So a nation's policy should be based on egoism just as the individual life is based on egoism. Now, here we're going to deal with the point Lucas raised. Does this prescription for foreign policy, namely that the nation should act on an egoistic basis, commit a collectivist fallacy? It makes sense for an individual to defend himself against attempts by others to violate its rights. But can we talk about a nation defending itself in the same way? So suppose you say, well, I'm trying to survive, so I act what's in my own interest. But the nation, there's no nation apart from the individual in it. As Alexander says, nation is just a group of individuals. So how can we talk about the national interest analogous to the interest of an individual? But I think the objectivists could probably get out of this objection. They could say they're just talking about rights of particular people who are in a group. They aren't assuming that nations of group exist in some further collectivist sense. So what they would say is, well, we're just saying, how can, say, all the people who live in the United States, say you, me, everybody else, how should we act toward people in other nations? And they would say on an egoist basis, we have, remember on the objections, there's a limited government that's supposed to be representing us, so how should that limited government act toward other governments? And we're not assuming that nations exist in some collective sense, groups are just, we're just saying how should these individuals act, and according to her, foreign policy should just be the same as we do in our lives. Generally, we should do it on an egoist basis. Now, it's interesting, at least I think so, it's interesting that, yes, that's right, and groups don't have rights as groups, it's just individuals in those few that have rights. Now, the objectivists have a well-deserved reputation for supporting an aggressive foreign policy. But even though they do that, they have some very important criticism of the neoconservatives. Remember, the neoconservatives are the ones who say, well, we need to get involved in the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. They're very interventionist. So you might think, well, the objectivists might, since they're supposed to be very aggressive in foreign policy, they would support the neoconservatives in these wars, but they don't. And it's interesting, very important to see why they don't support the neoconservatives. One of the principal views of the neoconservatives, neocons in foreign policy, is that we should support democratic revolutions all over the world. For example, in right after the 9/11 attacks in 2001, the neoconservatives like Robert Kagan was one, William Crystal, were saying, well, it would be desirable to have democratic revolutions all over the world, like especially in the Middle East. Wouldn't it be Saddam Hussein is a really brutal ruler, so shouldn't we support a democratic revolution there? This would be a good thing to do. Wouldn't it be nice to have democracies all over the world instead of these dictatorships? And we see this going on, this sort of argument going on right now. Some people say, well, look, Gaddafi in Libya is a really terrible person, so shouldn't we try to overthrow him with putting, try to have a democracy of Assad in Syria? Say, well, shouldn't we? Wouldn't it be good for the people there? Peggy asks, who's we? She means the foreign, the ones who are running the foreign policy, the government, say, especially the United States. What policy should the government of the United States or other countries follow? And the neoconservatives say what they should do is support democratic revolution. So you can see why would the objectivists disagree with this? Because they say this is altruistic. You're saying, well, neocons think democratic revolutions are good for people, but we don't have a duty to help other people achieve these goods. So this is altruistic. We shouldn't do this. So we have no duty to be altruistic. Maureen says she seems to support overthrowing governments that violate the rights of others if it's in our interest. Well, this, that you're very right to say, if it's in our interest, so this is the crucial point. We'll be getting to that in a short time, what is, when they think something is in our interest. But it isn't, it might be that particular governments that in fact violate others' rights are threatening us, so, and we have, it would be right in her view to respond to them, but it wouldn't be the fact that they're violating other people's rights that constitutes the threat. If you said, well, they're doing a bad thing because they're violating other people's rights, so we want to intervene to them. If we're doing this bad thing, then the evidentialists would say, no, that's altruism. We don't want it. We shouldn't be altruistic. That isn't self-interested. Now, the neocons might respond to this objection, say, well, we don't have this altruistic duty to help other people become democratic, but their policy isn't altruistic. The neocons believe in what they call democratic peace theory, which is the view that democratic nations don't go to war with each other. So it's in America's interest, in their view, to promote democratic regimes because the democracies won't go to war with each other. So if we get democracies in place, then we won't have to worry about these countries might attack us. So here the objectivists, I think, raise some good points. Thompson and Brooke raise some good points. It isn't the case always that democracies don't go to war with each other. For example, in the bank in Israel, the Palestinians elected the Hamas government, and they're certainly at war with Israel. So he could say, well, here's two democracies, they're fighting each other. Also, he said, well, I don't like Hamas, or like, some people might not like the Israeli government. So he might say, well, they're not democracies, but that isn't true, because democracy just means majority rule. So in the objectivist view, a democracy wouldn't be desirable unless the government is properly limited in accord with objectivist beliefs. So they, I think, they have some very good criticism of this democratic peace theory. The neocons, so I think they raise some good points against the neocons. Now, if objectivists reject neocon foreign policy, we've seen they do, they don't accept democratic peace theory, then we can ask, well, why did I say, why is their own foreign policy aggressive? Well, they say, well, they believe you can defend, the nation can defend itself against threats. So isn't that offensive rather than aggressive? So if what they're saying is, look, we have the nation, the U.S. should just defend itself against foreign countries that threaten us, why would one want to say that's an aggressive foreign policy, or one that, say, the majority might object to? And the problem here is that once a nation, in the objective view, thinks that it's under threat, then according to the objective, it can do anything it thinks needed to repel the threat. For example, suppose the U.S. thought that Iran's program to acquire atomic weapons might lead to an attack on us. We might say, well, how do we know that they seem to be acquiring atomic weapons? But how do we know that they're, if they do that, they're going to launch an attack on us? According to the objectivists, well, we don't have to know that. We can just think it would be, it might pose a threat to us if they got such atomic weapons. After all, they don't seem to like us very much. So this would certainly, if they got atomic weapons, we could say, well, it wouldn't be a very good idea. We would kind of think it would be more dangerous to us. On the objectivist view, is that we'd be justified in launching a preventive nuclear attack on it. Now, Bill Anderson says that doesn't think Iran has such a program. Well, I mean, that would be just an empirical matter. I was just going over actual policy in the Middle East, but just on how, what would be the case if, on the objectivist view of things, they say, well, supposing they're not actually having, suppose you're right, they're not actually trying to acquire atomic weapons, but at least there's some reason to think they are, so that would be enough for the objectivist to say, well, there might be some danger to us, so therefore we can really do what we want, we can blast them. That's right, Peggy said, the U.S. thinks they do, that justifies it. I mean, we would want to try, objectivists would think we should try to get accurate views, but we don't have to, in the objectivist view, wait till there really is a danger. We don't have to say we wait till they've got atomic weapons and think we're moving them into place against us to do anything. If we think there's a threat, then we can do it. We can take action against it. So I want to raise the question of what's wrong with this view? Aren't you justified in resisting threats and supposing you think somebody's going to kill you? Don't you have a right to take some action against them? Now, I think what seems to be wrong with it is, at least I think this, is that it has a consequence that once something is perceived as a threat, then the rights of anyone in the aggressor country, the country that perceives to be threatening us, lapse completely. So we want to ask, is this a plausible view? Suppose I'm giving a lecture, not over the internet now, but suppose, next week I'm supposed to be at the Mises Institute, I'll be giving some lectures. So suppose I have some reason to think that there's a person in the room who's going to kill me. I don't know who it is, but I just have good reason to think somebody's in the room going to kill me. Would I be justified in killing everyone in the room? I just say, well, there's somebody here who's going to try to kill me, so I'll just machine gun everybody. Then I make sure there's no one going to kill me. So ethical egoism seems to imply that it would be justifiable to do this, but I must say this seems intuitively to be a very morally implausible view. I could just kill anybody just because that would be one way of meeting the threat against me. Now, we can contrast the objective view with traditional just war theory, which was developed, goes back to St. Augustine, was developed by Catholic thinkers, and then later by Protestants like Hugo Grotius, and then was codified later by various writers in the 19th century. In traditional just war theory, wars can be undertaken only under very strict conditions. For example, war has to be a last resort, has to be carried out with a proper intention. By proper intention, you have to aim just at dealing with the immediate threat to you. You can't say, well, this country's threatening us, so we might as well go in and conquer them, get rid of them, add their territory to our country. We just have to respond to the actual threat. We can only use proportional force. I'm supposing, say, there's a minor border incursion against us. In traditional just war theory, we can't just drop nuclear bombs and destroy everyone in the country just because they cross the border. So the objectivist view rejects all these requirements, because remember, they're an egoist view. They say, once there's a threat, you can really do anything you want that you think would help you deal with the threat. Now, in the traditional view, besides the requirements on starting a war, there are restrictions on how a just war can be carried out. Say, even if, suppose, we're in a war justly, say another country just attacks us without provocation, so we respond to it. So that there's still limits to what we can do in the war. Most importantly, direct attacks on non-combatants are not allowed. So we can't say something like, well, say we're fighting Germany in World War II. We can't say, well, it would demoralize the German people if we just bombed some of the civilians. They actually did that. That wouldn't be allowed in traditional just war theory. So objectivists don't recognize these limits. And what they said, I think one person mentioned this in the chat, they think that civilians are at least partially responsible for their government, in the sense that, which is a familiar point, a government, if enough people in a country just refuse to obey the government at the same time, it would collapse. So they think, well, people are at least partially responsible for the government. And then you could say, well, what about people who oppose the government? What about babies? But they would say, either that's true, if your life is at stake, anything goes, so you're not bound by the limits. And Marie, would an objectivist call for the bombing of Dresden? Well, they wouldn't have to call for it, but they wouldn't have a moral objection to it. I mean, they would just say that would just depend on what they thought was the best way to win the war. There wouldn't be moral limits on it. So I want to now, just to conclude, just raise another problem for this view, is that, first, just point out how aggressive this policy would turn out to be depends on how objectives assess particular cases. For example, what we would do now would just depend on how they look at the world situation. I think Peikoff seems to take very seriously the notion of a threat to us from radical Islam, as he calls it, so I think he would be pretty aggressive. But what I wanted to raise, just to conclude, is a problem for this view. Which is, suppose you accept this view of a nation should try to follow an egoist policy analogous to individual. So very often, a threat by one country to another is not existential. Say one country not saying, well, we're going to come in here and kill everybody in the other country and put them under slavery. What they very often do, say, wars is just they want to change the government. They said, we want to put this in our territory rather than have it be independent. So egoism might not support an objective foreign policy in the certain sense of one word going destroying the other people because it's threatening you. Because what they're threatening to do would not be to kill you, but simply to change the government. So I think it's questionable to what extent, even if you accepted this egoist notion of foreign policy, it would justify the very aggressive policy that Peikoff and Yaron Brook favor. Okay, well, I guess we're about out of time now, so I see there are a lot of issues people wanted to discuss, so now is the time for objections, comments. Or somebody mentioned this. Dunning-Kruger effect, where people who aren't very good think they're superior. Well, that's very interesting. That would be kind of not directly the same, because it wouldn't follow that these people who do better, these people who aren't very good, do better than they would if they were perceive themselves accurately. I think very often when you have this Dunning-Kruger effect, people get into trouble because they start, so you see this on blogs, sometimes people will post on issues that they don't know anything about, so they'll just make themselves look foolish. And let me see, there's another question. If a country threatens your values, wouldn't you have an interest in stopping the aggressive country? You would, depending on what it was they were proposing to do. I mean, if say they were going to, say you were living in an objectivist government, they were going to replace it with a socialist dictatorship, then you would, in the objectivist, you have an interest in stopping them. I mean, supposing that they were just, you were living in a government that didn't reflect particularly your values, and it was another government that was proposing to invade, and that one was about the same in the degree to which it reflects your values, the one you're in now, it isn't clear that you'd be able to say, well, this nation is threatening us, so I can act, the nation should just act as if someone was threatening my life. Let's see, here's another one. Lucas said, Lucas wants to know, well, if we have popular sovereignty, where is the innocent civilian? Well, I mean, there would be people who might oppose the policy of people. Their children are too young to fight, or people who aren't involved in it. So I don't think you would say, even if the war has majority support, that everyone is supporting it in the the country. Okay. Anyone else? We still have quite a bit of time left. Alexander says you govern in manifestation of your values because government ought to do what is just. Well, Alexander, you're certainly right that government ought to do what's just, but it does according to your values, but it doesn't follow from that that they are doing what's just according to your values. You know, philosophers say that you sometimes raise the problem of can you get an ought from an is, and that dispute about it. I don't think you can get an is from an ought, so even if the government ought to be doing what you say, then it doesn't follow that they are supporting it down. Now, Ted wants to vote for the Ron Paul David Gordon ticket. Well, I'd take Ron Paul, but definitely not David Gordon ticket. Let's see, Peggy says here, Lysander Spooner. Yes, I think David Kelly points out Lysander Spooner had some very good criticism of the social contract. It's not binding on it. Some less who actually signed it. It's a very good, everybody should read Lysander Spooner, Constitutional Authority. There's a very interesting philosopher, Robert Paul Wolff, who had a book kind of even discovered Spooner. And he wrote a kind of an influential short book sort of defending this kind of argument. So I think this is a very good argument to raise, I guess. Bill Anderson said, how could someone like Rand allow the government to launch aggressive war? Who will pay? Well, Bill wants to know, how could the government launch a war if she doesn't believe in tax, or who's going to pay for it? Well, remember, in her view, the government is collecting user fee from the user fee that has enough to fulfill its function. And she thinks defense, which would include aggressive responses to threats, is part of the legitimate function of government. So she thinks that the user fees would pay for it. I mean, you could be skeptical about that. We would think people, they wouldn't have enough money to do much, but I guess she thought they would. Now, Charles wants to know, has anyone ever written a book relating her background to her objectionist views on war? Well, that's a very interesting suggestion. I think we could certainly think it's plausible to think that her very strong anti-communism had a lot to do with how she experienced her own experience of the Bolshevik Revolution. So I think that's a very good point. Yes, people like Lysander Spooner. Here's one. Now, Peggy suggests much of the warmongering public would fight down if the taxes were paid voluntarily. I think that's a good point. I mean, it's always easy to spend other people's money, but if you have to pay yourself and you have the option not to, I think that would be a good inducement for people not to pay. Now, Neil said, did Rand ever discuss the issue of secession and a solution to out-of-control government? I'm not aware of any discussion by her on that point. No, of course, Mises did not. One thing I should say, the objectivists who've written on the American Civil War tend to be very sympathetic to Lincoln. They're not sympathetic to sort of the Mises Institute. There's been writers like Tom DeLorenzo, have been extremely critical of Lincoln and pointed out that there was the Constitution was established on a strong basis of states' rights, and secession was a legitimate constitutional option. Now, objectivist writers written on the Civil War tend to be criticism. Tend not to accept that view. Okay, well, we let me see. We have someone else, some other people. We still have about 20 minutes left. Rand says governments are not. Yes, that's right. She believed in governments could be changed. Yes, that, the change has to be a philosophical one. Yes, that's a good point. I mean, they always laugh for any issue. What is the philosophical principles underlying it? So, for example, even in economic theory, say when the objections to economists, like Northrop Beekner's objections to economists, say, why do certain economists support antitrust policy, but the government's going to break up large companies? They say it's because of a philosophical error. There was John Ridpath, who's one of the judges, who argued that way. So they always look for the underlying philosophical error in what they're talking about. I'm sure if people in that Ayn Rand Institute were listening on my course, they'd find out what they discover, what my philosophical errors are to explain the criticism I have of objectivism. Alexander says, who is an objectivist economist? Well, one, I'll just put his name down. Northrop Beekner has a book coming out, I think called Objective Economics. And then one also who's been very influenced by objectivism is George Reisman, who's a friend of Rand's. He's not had a falling out with the Ayn Rand Institute, but he's a very good economist. I know him quite well, although I haven't talked to him too recently, but he used to lecture at the residency. Now, let me see. Someone wanted my email. I'll just put that down if you want my email. If there's my email. Now, let me see. Someone had a question here. Would Rand's mistakes vitiate the benefits of Rand's electoral spiritual sense of life? No, actually, I don't think so. I mean, you can still get a great deal from her fiction. Just to say, when we're reading Dostoevsky, we don't have to accept his rather strong adherence to Orthodox Christianity and anti-Semitism to find his novels a great novel. So I don't think we would have to say, if we think Rand made mistakes, that this really would interfere with enjoying her work and recognizing what she's done. I see people haven't gotten their books. Now, someone asked, is Rand's philosophy applicable to other cultures? Yes, I mean, I think there's certainly, she's right that the laissez-faire capitalism would benefit everybody. I mean, to the extent that there are problems with her philosophy, I don't think this would change from one culture to another. So I think she's certainly right that capitalism would be the best policy overall. I think it wouldn't be just peculiar to Western culture or other Americans, or everybody would benefit from capitalism. If Bill was pointing out, Hong Kong benefited from it. You'll be receiving. Now, Maureen wants to, can you run through Rand's view, right, explain why animals don't have it? Well, remember, according to Rand, basis of ethics is each person's survival as a rational being. So what I'm trying to do is promote my own survival. You're trying to promote your survival. Now, it's in my interest to cooperate with you and other people. We wouldn't want, according to Rand, say we were in a society where everybody's fighting each other, constantly having to look over our shoulder to see this person going to punch him. We wouldn't do very well. We were kind of in a Hobbesian state of nature, so it wouldn't be a good idea. We can benefit from cooperation with other people on the free market. Here Rand is very similar to Mises. We can all benefit from cooperation. So she thinks this is why we should respect other people's right to pursue their own self-interest and not be parasitic on them. We'd all be better off if we cooperate with one another. Now, animals, since they lack power of reason, really can't pose a threat to us in any way. So we don't have to take account of their interests. We're just free to use them in whatever way is beneficial to us. So Rand is very unsympathetic to views that postulate and or argue for animal rights. Tibor McCann, put him down. Who's an objectivist sympathizer, not him. He's not considered an objectivist in good standing, but he has a short book that I reviewed on animal rights, very critical of that. So the basic idea is, and we don't have to take account of animals because they don't pose any danger to our interests. We can just do what we want with them. Someone said Rand objectivism worked by a little no government. Well, Charles, remember she had very definite views on this. She believed in limited government, not anarchism. So she would think that objectivism worked best with just the sort of limited government she favored. I think you'll find this in discussing one of the earlier lectures, I think last week. In the final discussion of Rand on nature of government. So she wouldn't think it works best with no government. She's against anarchism. What was the name of the that was Galambos. Did any objectors ever address his views? I'll put him down. I don't know of any particular objectivist discussion of him, but he certainly knew Strebe. I don't know of any objectivist who would address that point. Neil says, she seems to be quite anarchism and nihilism. Just as objectivists see anti-IP people against creativity and intelligence. Yes, that's right. I mean, she thought that anarchists really didn't have the proper philosophical principles. So really, if they didn't have a proper philosophical principles, then she jumped in conclusion. They didn't have philosophical principles at all. They just didn't. She thought, well, if you're an anarchist, then you don't accept the need for an objective law code, as I tried to argue last time, that doesn't follow. You can be an anarchist and think there is an objective law code, just you think there should be competing agencies to enforce the law code. Bill wants to know, what's the topic in my Netflix? What I'm going to do there, I hope people will enroll in it, is I'm going to talk about libertarianism and contemporary philosophies. What I'm going to do, I'm going to take certain philosophers like G.A. Cohen, Robert Nozick, Thomas Nagel, David Gauthier, who've written on issues that are related to libertarianism, cynical, sympathetic, like Nozick. So I want to discuss philosophical issues they've raised. And the reason I hope people will talk, enroll in the classes, sometimes when we're libertarians, we tend to limit ourselves to authors who are important to us, but philosophers who are important to us, but aren't studied as much in mainstream philosophy. For example, Ayn Rand, if you took a course at a university in philosophy, you probably wouldn't get Rand as one of the main people. So what I want to do in this course will consider some of the philosophers who really are very big names in contemporary philosophy, like John Rawls, others. And some of these ones, not all of them, I'll be discussing with people I've known, like Bob Nozick, Tom Nagel, I know a little bit, G.A. Cohen I had some emails on Gauthier I met. So I'll be discussing some of these mainstream figures. If you take the course, you'll get a good understanding, at least I hope it'll give you, on what some of the main issues are in contemporary moral philosophy. Let's see, Dante has some lens doesn't exist in reality. It's a concept based on the reception. Does time exist, or is it just a concept based on the perception of change? Well, that's a very good question. I don't have a good answer for you. I mean, there are different theories on that. There are some who would take a view that it's just a concept based on perception change. There are others who say, no, there's such a thing as time that exists absolutely apart from things that are changing. That's a very difficult philosophical question. I don't have a good short answer for you. It's just there are whole books on philosophy of time. I would just say, just be careful just about accepting one view as obviously true. It's just a very difficult topic. I don't have a fixed view on it myself. Leibniz held the view that you're suggesting, but there's all sorts of different views on the matter. Yes, that's right. You could sell your product with a stipulation saying that you won't copy it. That's exactly what he meant, like in the contractual stipulation. You could sell a book to someone with a stipulation to not copy it. So that would be voluntary, as I mean, it would be, but you wouldn't be binding anyone who hadn't signed the agreement. Well, Peggy said she's an anarchist, non-nihilist. Well, that's in your fond of animals. Well, that's a very good combination, Peggy. We should be more people like you, especially people who enroll in my courses. Well, you mentioned you're fond of animals. I could tell a joke on this subject, but I better not. It's too risky. Unless someone insists on hearing it, of course. Okay, now Charles, what level of regulation would you think is too much from the issues the U.S. Constitution? She thinks really anything would be too much, like that goes beyond really defense, protection of people, so she rejects all economic regulation. I don't think she used the U.S. Constitution as a framework. I think she'd think it's a good thing to the extent it can be used to limit the government. I don't think she'd attach value to the Constitution in itself, say the Constitution, gives the government certain powers. I don't think she would give it, but I mean, I think she would probably favor a more strict interpretation of the Constitution more than she wouldn't favor the liberal ones. lets me not necessarily buy it. Oh, she, so Peggy, you're not, when you like animals, it doesn't necessarily bother you. So you're a size, if the animal's small enough, then you don't like a virus, and I suppose you know you're an animal. Jonathan wants to know, what if you modify the product? Well, I mean, unless you were prohibited by doing that in the agreement, you could do that. Now, the question is, well, if you modified it enough, would you still be bound by the original agreement not to copy it? That would have to be written into a contract. Oh, Noreen says, you want me to go ahead with the joke. Well, all right. There was a story. A man came into a pet shop and said, I'd like to buy a parrot. So the owner of the store said, well, we got this special parrot here. It costs $500, but it speaks 8 languages and sings grand opera. I think it's one of a kind. So I know 500 is a lot of money. So the man said, I don't care about any of that. What I want to know is it tender? Well, I bet you're sorry you told me to go ahead with that. Let me see. If you think tax should be voluntary, it doesn't make you pretty close to an anarchist. Well, see, the difference is you don't have to pay the government if you don't want to, but if you don't pay, your contracts won't be enforced and you can't set up a competing group to defend yourself. So it's sort of you have a choice. It's something like you don't have to pay for police protection, fire protection, if you don't pay for it, then you won't be able to do anything if somebody robs you, so you have a pretty strong incentive to pay. Marie didn't like the joke too much. Well, I warned you. I warned you. Legal tenure, that's very good. Very good. Let's see. Sounds like a W.C. Fields, so I guess it's probably a double boo for Ted. That's one of my milder ones. Rim shot. Oh, good. Neil wants to know, who are my favorite contemporary philosophers? Well, of course, I like Bob Nozick a great deal. Now, one I think very highly of is Tom Nagel at NYU. Jerry Fodor is very good. He's written Philosophy of Mind, and would be some of the others. Alvin Plantinga is a very good philosopher. I like mainstream analytic people. Gandhi wants to know about how human action would be Austrian economics relates to objectivist philosophy. Well, objectivists could take over a good part of Austrian economics. Remember, Rand thought very highly of Mises, but not all of it. She didn't like this objective theory of value too much. And Peggy said, please type the names. All right, well, I'll just put in some. All right. And those are a few, I would say. Good philosophers, people I think are worth reading. Yes, I think good. Neil had the same one. Good. Of course, I've had, I know that it was, of course, the one I knew best, Nagel, second best. I've had a few emails from Jerry Fodor. I met Frank, but I never emailed him. So, of course, Bob knows it was my friend for 20 years. Well, I guess, Danny says, which are the main founding fathers of the current mainstream analytic philosophy? Well, I should mention another great one is Saul Kripke. He's one of the greatest, Saul Kripke. Well, I think probably the founders would probably be, you have to go with who would be some of the founders, like I'll just put these are ones I'd say extremely influential. Well, I guess we're about out of time now, so I want to thank everybody for coming to my. Yes, actually, Scott Soames, that's very good, Neil. It's a very good book to read, analytic philosophy. So thanks for coming to my course. I appreciate everybody's coming. Sorry for all my bad jokes, and I hope to see many of you in my next course. So thanks a lot, everybody. Well, I'll have another quiz for you right away, and then when it's up, when it's that'll be up to Danny. Thank you, Mark. Thanks, everybody. Okay, did I hit return? Yes, I think I did. Okay, well, thanks, everybody. So I'm going to stop the video now.